Hello, everyone. Thank you for checking out this special episode of Really Dicey. This is Manny, and I am here with...
Jay Soydelius.
And today we're going to talk about Draconicus. It's a very interesting role-playing game that was first a board game. Am I correct in understanding that?
That is correct, yeah.
And it looks like it's influenced with not just dragons, but also the whole Roman mythology, you know, the culture, armor.
Yeah. Religion. Or more specifically, I think you would say the British Isles localized version of the Roman Empire. Very much so. And I wanted to do that because I wanted to kind of back away from, there's too much going on in the medieval area with role-playing games anyway. So I want to kind of back it up historically a little bit so that there was more of an ambiguity about the historical facts, because this is obviously not our history. It's a brand new setting. So it's inspired by, you know, Roman Empire and not necessarily analogous to it.
Oh, okay. And this is not a 5e source book. This has its own...
It's got its own system. Yeah, it's proprietary for the Yellow Hand, which is the publishing imprint that we're running and publishing this through. So it's our first original system. We've previously published a game called Sentience, which is a robot role-playing game that is based on Modiphius's 2D20 system. But this is the first system of our own that we've put out.
Yeah, and you are the creator of this game.
I am. I do have quite a few co-creators, yes, but I started it, and basically the impetus to build it from the based on the board game that came from me, because I had kind of taken on a challenge of making a board game of a different IP originally. And I just wanted to prove that it could be done. And once I'd done that, I thought that, you know what, this could be published probably. And I reached out to the publisher and to see if they were interested. And they were taking a little bit too long for my taste. I'm kind of an impatient person. So I just forged ahead and thought, you know, I can make that into its own IP. I can switch out anything that's in here and build a new world, basically. And that I think that's something that I would really actually recommend to a lot of designers. Because starting with a board game means that you have to have components very well defined, and it's very easy to continue to build from that, as opposed to if you're starting to build a role-playing game from scratch, you are really, you know, in deep, and there's a lot of stuff that you have to think through before you get started. So with the board game, you're kind of, you know, just moving forward in little steps at a time, and you're defining little pieces that you can then continue to evolve.
So if I may ask, why Draconicus? You could have done any subject matter, any setting. You could have done space. You could have done prehistoric times. Why this?
Well, so actually, the mechanics of the board game started with an Old West game, because that's one of my big loves in terms of setting material. So I had a semi-finished board game already that is set in the Old West and that I'm planning to get back to. And I started thinking about, can I map this to more of a medieval or a fantasy setting? And it looked like it could be done. And then this challenge came up where I basically just, decided that I'm going to prove that this can be done with this other IP. And when I had to put my own kind of IP, my own world together, and then think about what I wanted to do, this period of history has always been really big for me. I really like the, there's particularly a writer called Rosemary Sutcliffe. She's been long dead, but she was an amateur archaeologist and historian, and she wrote, I think you would call them young adult books today, and the biggest one I think that's been turned into a movie also was called Eagle of the Ninth. The movie was called Eagle, the Eagle, and so it takes place in Britain, but it's before King Arthur. It's before, you know, all the medieval stuff that we know from Richard the Lionheart and the type of typical fantasy environments that you would see with feudalism and all that. So you get back up and get a little bit more into the borderline between the Roman Empire and the Vikings invading Britain. And that to me is a really interesting, you have both of those things, you know, going on right then. And then that is just a naturally interesting kind of setting and appeared in history for me. And so that's what I tried to do. And the thought was, you know, Gladiator is a really good movie. Add dragons to it, and you know, you have something to work with.
So, even though the game's inspired by all that, it's not that same. We're not playing ancient or old Britain.
Correct. Well, I mean, so this is a separate world called Draconicus. That's the name of the world. And this was an old idea that, that me and some friends had had kicking around for a long time, really, where we were thinking of, you know, a world made out of dragons. We were thinking basically, what can you do with dragons? Because dragons are cool, but throw dragons into something and you have Dungeons and Dragons, or you have whatever role-playing game you might, you know, want to compare to, because there's dragons in all of them. And we figured, what can you do more than that? Well, make a world that's built of dragons, by dragons, and consists of dragons, basically. So I started with this map here that you can see in the background, and figured I'll turn this map into something that looks like a dragon. And then I thought, why would there be a dragon? Why would it look like a dragon? And I figured, what if the dragons actually built it, and they built it, they created it in order to be worshipped? So then started to move along on some sort of cosmology that I thought seemed like it had something, you know, there was something interesting in it. And so the idea, basic idea, is that in our cosmology for this world, the gods sent the dragons to this planet to build it and make it habitable. And the dragons have reality altering power. So they can basically create rivers, they can create lakes, they can create mountains, they can create everything in the world. And then they basically use elementals to fuel them. So you have water elementals then that, that flow through the rivers and kind of animate the rivers. And to create this kind of idea of a world that was built by dragons. But then it seemed to me like if the dragons are creating the world as or almost like an effigy of themselves, then wouldn't the gods be mad at them? And so we figured out that, you know, that maybe the dragons are cursed and they are no longer awake. So they were cursed. And the idea is basically that they fell asleep. And since they created the world, they still have these reality altering powers. But if they're asleep and they're dreaming, what does that do for the world? Do they still affect the world? And figured that that's an interesting angle to work from. So what if a dragon falls asleep in the middle of nowhere and it starts dreaming and its job was to create a mountain range? Well, if it's dreaming, it's probably still doing that. So it's basically building the mountain range up on top of itself. So this, then you have a world that literally is built upon dragons, and the dragons are still there somewhere, but you can't see them. And I thought that that has something, that that's a world that you can kind of play with a lot and get a lot of kind of mythology from. So that's how it started.
Wow. It sounds like it's almost very fluid, the setting.
It certainly can be. Yeah, we do have ideas for, obviously this wouldn't happen all the time, or the it would be very disruptive, but you can certainly have adventures where, you know, let's say that you're visiting a little lake somewhere and it turns out that something you do awakens that dragon. Well, the lake turns into a dragon, and now what are you going to do? So yeah, there's a certain element of reality changing in front of your eyes, and I can't think of anything that is, you know, more terrifying, but also kind of more exciting than that. So that seems like a good story driver.
So who can you be exactly in this world?
Well, so this is a very analogous world to our own. And it has a set of, you know, realms with political power, feudal power. Some of them are republics, early republics. You have, you know, high classes, low classes, you certainly have mages, you have scholars, you have all the types of, there are tribes that are populating this world that are kind of existing outside. So like the Picts or the Celts, they're existing kind of outside of what here would be a Roman analogous society. The one thing that I wanted to change was I didn't want this to be the Roman Empire, just a duplicate of the Roman Empire, or even the Roman Empire as it existed in Britain. I wanted there to be a different take on it, where it wasn't just a conquering power, because that gets a little too militaristic for my taste, and it also gets kind of rigid. So instead, I kind of applied the idea of, I don't know if you've heard of the Hanseatic League, which is a little later in history, but it was basically a trade federation that started in Germany, I think Bremen and Hamburg, among others. And it was basically in control of many different, a network of cities across Europe that were basically free towns and sort of kingdom a network of kingdoms laid on top of other kingdoms. And I thought that what if you take the Roman Empire, but you translate it into this trade federation, and suddenly you have something that where the structure of society is motivated by trade, but you then also have vast gaps where trade doesn't go because, you know, you can send a military force to conquer any part of any land, but trade wouldn't go there if they can't trade with the people who are there. So then you get a little bit of a looser society where there's more opportunities for adventure. So that, but the people of themselves are pretty much analogous to what we would have had in Earth's 500s, maybe around there, 400 or 500s.
Well, one of the taglines for this game is dragon magic. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, so obviously, since it's a fantasy game, we wanted there to be magic, and we had to think about what does magic look like in this world. And it seemed pretty obvious to us that it has to involve the dragons themselves, because we figured that the dragons will be the source of the magic, because we already established that dragons affect reality. And basically, if you can persuade a dragon subconsciously, obviously, since the dragons are all asleep, if you can persuade it to expend some of its dream power to alter reality on your behalf, you have magic. All you have to think about is what kinds of dragons are there, and what kind of magic do they kind of, what kind of powers do they have over reality? So we thought about different classes of dragons there that can do different things, because obviously they'd been sent to the world to shape the world in different aspects of the world in different ways. And so that was one part of the magic, but then we also figured, what is it that you're really manipulating if you're communicating with a dragon? And we figured that has to be emotions. So the idea is that the magic that you execute is basic as a mage in this game is basically you manipulate the emotions of a dragon. You can certainly make it angry, you can make it joyful, you can make it sad, you can make it contemplative and thoughtful, and all of that then affects what you can do through the dragon's mind to reality. And that formed kind of a matrix that we could create a magic system from. Now, it should be said that in doing so, we were also thinking that this is reality altering. There has to be forces that are not liking this altering of reality. And then we went back to the gods and basically created the gods and the religions as opposed to magic. So basically, the religions are founded in the natural sciences, and they then want to counteract the magic that is being done because they see it as disruptive, or, you know, as it would be, you know, obviously if you have a, if you have a realm that is where something can affect reality, you're probably going to want to tamp down on that. If, especially if you're the king of that realm, you want to stay in control. You know?
So let's talk a little bit about the rule system.
Yeah.
Unique to this game. Yep. How would you describe it?
So I'm not a huge fan of completely narrative game systems. I enjoy playing them, but there's a part of it. I'm a game designer, and I started with this as a board game. So mechanics matter to me, and I feel like mechanics need to propel the narrative. It's not just the narrative kind of affecting the mechanics and the mechanics being completely fluid. So I wanted there to be a robust system in the bottom of it. And I've always liked dice pools. I think they offer you a lot of flexibility. And the board game is actually using, you might call it a mini dice pool system, because you only, everything is rated from 1 to 3, which translates into 1 to 3 dice. And you pick the highest die. So that's the core mechanic of the board game. And I was thinking I can probably apply that to the role-playing game as well, but make it a little bit more open-ended. So basically, if you're a novice at anything, you would only roll 1 die. If you're an expert at something, you would roll 3 dice. And then the result would be you would pick the highest die, and that would indicate your result. And I settled on D10s, because I think the 1 to 10 scale translates very easily to percentages, and that makes it easy for people to understand. You know, you had have a 1 in 10 chance of succeeding at something, whereas if you had used, you know, a D8 or something like that, or a D6, it becomes a little bit, percentages aren't quite as apparent, and then your chances of succeeding aren't materializing as clearly in the game. So that's really what it is. You might call it a mini dice pool system, given that it's only 1 to 3. So that's the core task resolution mechanic, basically.
Okay, and just a brief example. So let's say my character wanted to climb a wall.
Right.
How would the mechanics work exactly for that?
Yeah, so if you have an aptitude, so you might have a natural aptitude to it that we would, you know, in other role-playing games, we would call characteristics or attributes. They're called attributes here. And those are reflect natural aptitudes, and you can have 1 to 3. So that allows you to roll 1 to 3 dice. Or if you have expertise in it, you have training, you have some sort of professional schooling in something, then you might be able to apply that if that is higher. So that's up to you. If you have expertise, you can apply it, and then you can probably do better. And then what you're rolling against is a difficulty rating, and the difficulty rating is 1 to 10. And you need to beat that. And if you beat it, then you have succeeded. And then given that we're working with a 1 to 10 range, you can also use the die result as a quality rating. So basically, if you roll a 9, that's very high, which means that you've succeeded very well. And if you're producing anything that's worth a 9 out of a 10 graded scale, so that also indicates that what you're producing is a very high quality. And you can then use that to test it, basically. If you can break it and roll higher than the 9, then you've broken that element that you created. Let's say that you're creating a sword and it has a quality rating of 9. Well, it only breaks if you roll a 10. Anything else?
Interesting.
Holds together. And if you wanted to climb the wall, to use that example, you would obviously factor in what's the difficulty rating. Is it easy? If it's a slight incline, you would get a 1 or 2 difficulty rating, maybe. There are plenty of examples in the rule book of what would be a suitable difficulty rating for a task. If it's basically impossible, then it's a 10. So you can't do it unless you basically you outperform yourself. Those are the key elements of the system. And then everything is basically tested against that 1 to 10 scale.
The art direction for this book is amazing. What can you tell us about it?
Well, I mean, I'm a graphic designer first and foremost, and I'm from Stockholm, Sweden, and I used to work in the game industry in the 90s. I worked for a publisher that is now, I think they've gone through numerous iterations. I think they're now known as Paradox Interactive, and they mostly do computer games. But back then they did role-playing games and board games and family board games as well. And I was working there as an art director. And so that's my schooling. I came up through publishing. I'm a graphic designer myself, and doing this book, something that I've found that is very helpful for me, I don't know if it is for everybody else, but since I'm a graphic designer, it helps me to have the visuals done first and to have a visual framework, because to me, it's easier to write to something that already exists, even if it's just an outline or a disposition. And in this case, it's a layout. It tells me, what do I have to write? And to me, that solves a very core issue. I know a lot of writers run into writer's blocks, and that almost never happens for me because I always know what I need to write and where. So even if I find it, you know, it's sluggish, it's slow going, I know what it is I need to write to plug in a certain gap in the material that I've created. So I lead with the design, but that's also obviously because I'm a graphic designer, I start with the visuals. That's what I think of first, you know. And in this case with Draconicus, it started with the map, really, you know, the idea of the world as a dragon. Well, I create that map, and then I start thinking, what can I stuff into this map, basically? So that's the whole book has evolved out of that, basically, a visual framework that I've then written stuff for.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. I think you're one of the few people I've interviewed that is both a writer and a graphic designer of a role-playing game. Usually, you might find something like that in comic books, in graphic novels, where you see the writer and the artist, and it's a very interesting product.
Yeah, I do have a background in comics as well.
Oh.
that was probably my second career choice as a kid. You know, I wanted to either be a comic book artist or a game designer, and comic book art is creating comic books. It's really fun, but it's very hard work, and there's a lot of stuff that needs to go into it. And what doesn't suit my temperament, I found gradually as I tried my hand at it, is that you do the same thing over and over again. Whereas if you design a game, you move forward all the time and you add new things to it. But if you're doing a comic book, then you're writing it, then you're writing the dialogue, and then you're sketching it, and then you're inking it, and then you're coloring it, and then you're doing the print production for it. So it's the same. You're processing the same material over and over again. And I don't have the patience for that. I just need to move forward. So game design has suited me better, for sure.
Oh, wow. Oh, okay. Okay. So if I may ask, what's been some of your favorite characters that you've made for your game that you've play tested?
Wow, that's a good question. I mean, there are many little things there that when you have decided that you need to write them, that they surprise you, because you then start, your brain starts ping-ponging back and forth about what can I make of this? And you didn't think, like, I never thought that I would be writing about fictional fantasy religions. That was not on my radar at all. But once you've decided that you have gods in this game and you decide that people are worshiping these gods, that's a really interesting process to start to think about, why do they worship these gods? What is it about them that garners worship? And then also thinking about, you know, what is religion really? It's kind of, you know, not getting into the whole religion discussion for our world as humans, but having one god is a little boring when you look at the Greek mythology, the Roman mythology, you know, India. Shintoism has been a huge influence on me conceptually. I'm not, you know, a scholar on Shintoism, but the concepts of Shintoism with animism and spirits that inhabit the world, in sometimes in a very localized fashion, but also sometimes you can have a continent that's actually a spirit. To me, that was something that I discovered through doing this, that this is actually fun to write about, and that surprised me. So I have a bias towards the religions in this game, but I don't think that that's necessarily going to be the big selling point for, you know, buyers. It's more of a spice that you add to the game.
Well, I personally enjoy how religion is portrayed in role-playing games. I get annoyed, especially with some of the older games, I won't mention names, that don't, they have gods in there, but it doesn't really affect the world in any way, or affect the cosmology, or the culture. Is just, it seems so separate, and that just drives me a little.
No, I agree 100%. I'll show my biases here, but my first love in role playing was RuneQuest, and it's still the same because of the cults in RuneQuest, because it's so rich. And the gods are so detailed, as if they are real characters, and then, you know, it's almost it's a setting that is so deep with so many different aspects of religions affecting the gameplay. And I think that's where you want to be. There's no point in having it if it doesn't affect the game in some way and affect the mood of the game, if you will.
So Draconicus, is that a one book, one complete game in itself? Do you need more the books
book,
or?
Yes, there is a version of it that is a complete book, and that comes in print on demand. It's a soft cover book and a hardcover book, and I would strongly recommend the hardcover book because it came out really nice, I think. That is, in fact, consists of six smaller books that you can buy separately. And the reason for that was really that I think that sometimes you have players who want to have parts of the rules, but they may not want to have some of the game master's rules, because those are for a different aspect of the game that they don't necessarily want to be privy to or aware of. There's adventures, obviously, that you as a player you don't want to have, and there's an introductory adventure in the book. So, and then another thought there was that there's a setting book separately that is the first chapter in the book. The complete role-playing game. And the setting book, I always felt like if this has legs and it can be usable to people, they think that this is enjoyable, they don't have to use it with my system. They can just take the setting book and use it somewhere else with another system that they prefer. So the hardcover or the hard and soft cover books, those consist of the setting book, a player handbook, which contains all the rules for creating a character, but also the actions that you can do as a character, combat, magic, that sort of thing. And then there's a game master book. That's the third book that contains everything for you that is needed for you to kind of animate the game with everything that needs to happen. And that also includes quests that are kind of plot ideas. So there's 27 of those. And the reason for that is that they are actually the same as in the board game. So you play a quest, you solve a quest in the board game, but we've expanded those in the role-playing game so you can have them as scenarios and adventures. So there's 27 of those in the Game Master chapter. And then there's things like, you know, equipment and treasure and that kind of stuff. That's the third book. And the fourth book is an introductory adventure. And then there's a bestiary as well with all the monsters that you might think of. They borrow heavily from Greek and Roman mythology, but there's a little bit of a spin on them as well. And obviously there's dragons, plenty of dragons in there. And then after the bestiary, there's also a reference booklet that you can get separately, but it's more of a companion piece to the setting book. So there's a lot of pronunciation guidelines for it. And if you don't remember what something is, it's easy to just pick up the separate booklet and look through it and see, you know, alphabetically, what is this term? What is this name? Because one of the things that's always bugged me in, especially in fantasy role-playing games where so many names are made up, it's hard to remember them all. So I'm interested in linguistics. So I've tried to give all the words and all the names some kind of anchoring to a human language that we are familiar with a root of a word that you can then use to remember what was this. So if there's a mountain somewhere, why don't I use some, call it pidgin Latin base for what a mountain is called in Latin, and then I add to that name so that all the mountains have this base, you know, faux Latin root that is going to make it easy for you to remember. What am I talking about? Am I talking about, you know, a city? Is it a lake, a river? Well, it's a mountain. Okay. That's a little easier to remember then. So that's been kind of a driver behind this game doesn't have a unique languages like some games have, or Tolkien or Game of Thrones or what have you, but it is definitely based in human languages, but mostly for flavor, so that you get the sense of this language here and these words that are used right here, they come from a certain part of this world.
And is this available right now through DriveThruRPG?
It is available right now, yes. Selling on DriveThruRPG. It is available digitally as well. So you can definitely just get the PDFs and download them. Since I'm a print designer at heart, I like to see books laid out as spreads. You know, the problem with PDFs is that you tend to look at them one page at a time, and for me, something that creates a more pleasurable reading experience is to have left and right side of a spread. That means that you can orient things on the page a little bit differently, and it makes for a more varied reading experience. If you're reading single pages all the time, the layout repeats every page, and to me that doesn't give as much of a pleasurable experience in reading it or just flipping through it. So it was important to me that we could also do these as printed books.
Hmm. If I may ask, how long did it take you to put this book together?
Not quite as long as you might think. I mean, it's been a lot of work for sure. And I did have a lot of help from my co-creators here. But given that we started with the board game and the board game had gotten quite far, it was all kind of laid into place already. So all we had to do was plug in, you know, basically fill in gaps where we had very little information. There might've been, you know, a card in the board game that only said a few little things about the world. And then we had to think about how do we expand this so that it becomes more substantial. So the board game has been in the works for 3 years, and the role-playing game is just under 2 years. But some of the role-playing materials were written originally for the board game and were just basically ported over.
Oh, okay. Now, I know some people that tend to sometimes buy, let's say, for example, Dungeons & Dragons, something, they'll have a board game, and they'll mine the board game for, like, miniatures and dice and things like that. Can you do something like that with the Draconicus board game?
You will once the board game is released. We have 3D printed miniatures, so that we're using them for the prototypes for the board game. But the board game is not produced yet, so that'll be probably, I'm going to be a little conservative and say that it's probably going to be a year until the board game is produced. But we have all the files are all ready to go, and I do have a production quote. I've selected the production and fulfillment partner. So it's a question of pushing the button and could do it as a crowdfunding campaign, which is the initial where we're going to go with it initially. But it might there might be other ways of getting it out there. But it's ready to go. And once it comes out, you can use the materials interchangeably. The board, the game board and the board game is perfectly usable with the role-playing game. You could use it as a mat for what happens in the game, basically, a game map.
And just to be clear, the dice, it sounds like you only need D6s?
No, D10s. Well, the board game is D10s. D6s, yeah. But the role-playing game is D10s. But I should say that you do need a full range of dice because the game scales with the type of die used. So humans use D10s, whereas, you know, a dog might use a D6 and a dragon might use a D20. So D10s is what you use as a player, but the GM will definitely need a full set of dice.
Wow. I am sold. This sounds marvelous. And I love, again, the setting sounds great. The character building here sounds great, but I'm really intrigued with the, what work you put in for the religion, the cosmology of this world. Is there any last words you want to say about this before we wrap up?
Well, we do have other products coming out. One thing that I really want to do that I don't know if I'll be able to get around to because it'll be a lot of work. This was my I think you would call it a pandemic project. I produced a campaign for the role-playing game Harnmaster. That's this one here. It's 350 pages, something like that. This is a campaign that I had running for a long time that I decided that I might as well put it together in some sort of publishable shape. And I figured that I can easily adapt it to the Draconicus as well. And in fact, it'll fit really well. It's just going to be a lot of work to to transpose it. So that's something that I'm looking forward to doing, but it's probably going to take me a year or so.
Mm. Oh, excellent. And is there a website that people can check out more of what Yellow Hand offers?
Yes. So if you go in through draconic.us, which is the website for Draconicus, you can get to the Yellow Hand website from there. But the Yellow Hand also has a separate website called theyellowhand.com.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Excellent. Well, Jay, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this project.
Thank you.
And viewers, I will put all the links in the description below. Be safe out there. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Manny.